Welcome back to Skiptotopia. As always, I'm your host, Maxwell Cody. And joining me tonight, after a very, how shall we put it, a very difficult scheduling journey, it's Sean Jewel. I'm going to christen you Sean Jewel, like Jewel the vape. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, you can spell it that way if it pleases you.
Right. How are you doing, Sean?
Pretty good. Yeah, I thought that was just your vetting process, like everyone, like, had to like go through.
Oh no. I'm usually not even close to that much of an asshole to most people who come on this podcast. So you should feel special
that it's I okay. Went through such a process for you. Confusing as fuck because we don't do time zone switches.
Uh-huh.
And so like everything just moves around us. The whole world shifts around Arizona.
What do you mean Arizona doesn't do time zone shifts?
Like you're 2 hours ahead of me right now. Mm-hmm. But everywhere else in the country, everywhere else in my time zone, you'd be 3 hours ahead of me. But Arizona's just like, nah.
Oh, I see. All right.
Yeah. So,
all right, Sean. You, I know, are eager to talk about a great many things. You're a netizen. This is a netizen episode. But first, I want to talk to you about chocolate. You said something. I said it was Zoomer because I didn't realize that we're actually the same age. So I guess it's actually just very millennial. But you had a vegan chocolate company. What is that?
Yeah, it's still around. I started working there in like the early 2010s. And then after one of the guys left, I bought his portion of the company. Mm-hmm. And then hung out doing that till about 2021 and then bugged out of the Bay. And did like a decade in chocolate.
Okay. And, what was that like? What's the essence of vegan chocolate?
It was weird to like grow a company as like sort of a psychology and art major. I just like fucking stumbled assed into it. But it was fun. Like, I mean, I got into it from like, it's really fucking funny to see all the like health and wellness, like memetics that have like crept into like Zoomer culture because like, and it's actually kind of fucking tiring. So I'm not like singing my own praises here. Like I've been on that shit since like 2009, like fucking like microplastics and like getting sunlight and, you know, raw dairy and like,
mm-hmm. Well, that's not vegan.
Well, no, I mean, I was vegan. Like there's a whole fucking like arc to like veganism that a lot of like, I think like Western European people go, especially because I just think our genetics are not typically lined up to thrive on like a vegan diet for very long.
Mm-hmm.
So like, okay. A lot of
is
people,
is anyone's genetics really lined up to be on a vegan diet for very long? I think
depending, you know, I've seen, because I worked at farmers market for this fucking company for like 10 years straight, so I'd probably talk to several thousand vegans. And some of them would be like, I've been vegan for 10 years, and they'd be glowing. They literally look like sunlight was shooting out their eyes. And then some would be like, I've been vegan for 10 years, and it looked like a stiff breeze would just turn them to dust. They looked like they were like, I could see them decaying. Like things were falling off of them. Like I would have sworn they had leprosy. Their eyes were so far sunken in their heads, I could barely see them. They were like speaking to me out of like a deep, dark cavern of delusion that this diet was working for them.
All right, but couldn't that be, you know, before we get into like some really sketchy ethno-vegan theory, couldn't it just be that some people are better at being vegans than others? I mean, I'm happy to concede this because, you know, I remember hanging out with a vegan in Portland once, and she kept saying, like, if there's one thing I want to do, it's that I want to destroy the stereotype that vegans need to be healthy. And the whole time she was showing us where to get like deep fried vegan food, basically. That was like the whole gist of it. I was like, okay, you know, any health benefit you get from being vegan, I'm sure, you know, is negated by all this deep fried shit. So
mission accomplished. They did the hell out of that. Like, point proven tenfold. And yeah, it's like our chocolate company, like, we also were not using refined sugar and like no preservatives and stuff. We were like really trying to like make like the nth level, like, holistic chocolate solution that would like satisfy every diet. We're actually coming out of the raw vegan subgenre of vegan, like, which is you don't eat anything that's been exposed to a temperature above a debated 103 to 111 degrees.
Is it when you get to this like deep raw vegan phase that you begin to be like, I'm so vegan now that I've somehow began to talk myself into this post-vegan phase where actually raw milk is the answer to all my problems? Is that what happened?
That is exactly true. Like, because like you can't really, most people except like very old ladies who have like a base metabolism of like 800 calories per day can't survive on that diet. I was a raw vegan for several years and it was a fucking train wreck. Like, it like was like 3 months of like euphoria mixed with like a year of delusion. Mm-hmm. And so you see there's like a weird like horseshoe where you find your way back to animal products in the most like bizarre holistic way. There was one guy, what's his name? He's like he's just sort of like the quintessential godfather of like raw veganism, like raw veganism. I think his name is David Wolf. And I haven't kept up with him, but last I heard, he was like advocating like eating ground up deer antlers.
Yeah, that seems more Wolf to me. A guy named Wolf who's a vegan. Definitely, yeah. That's definitely a man of sheep's clothing.
Yeah, he was really into our chocolate for a minute, and then he started his own chocolate company that used maple sugar instead of coconut sugar, and that was like
wow. He really one-upped you, huh?
Yeah, he...
Classic Wolf behavior. Classic Wolf behavior.
Yeah. He bleeded us for our industry secrets, and then...
So you're not a vegan anymore?
No, I dropped out.
I saw you eat a real burrito.
Yeah, you saw me eat a California burrito.
Okay, but how long were you vegan?
I was vegetarian for 2-ish years, and then vegan for 3-ish years, and then raw vegan for like a year. And then like I started
would you say you were a strict raw vegan? You did a full year of strict raw veganism?
I like gradiated into it and gradiated out of it. Like, for a month I ate only fruit, which feels pretty strict. But
what kind of fruits? What was the go-to fruits during this like peak?
Well, I wasn't like rolling in cash at the time, so I would just like go to this
broke raw vegan.
Yeah, I would like work. I would go to like a lot of fucking bananas, obviously. Okay. Like, you know, bananas were like my wheat.
Yeah.
And a lot of stone fruit and a lot of that's like pretty much it. Any other fruit that was around. It was ungodly how much fruit you could eat and then be hungry like an hour later. It was intimidating. It was an intimidating diet. And I just moved to the Bay then. And I was working on a falafel food truck. And like, it was like really hard to like keep secret because I was sort of embarrassed because it was like sort of an embarrassing way to live. And I'm like, oh, you know, I was in my early 20s. So I was a little less confident in like being a weirdo. And, but I like had to like constantly sort of dodge like why I wouldn't eat anything out of the falafel food truck.
Well, I mean, I can understand if you work at a halal food truck where they serve meat and they ask you like, why don't you want to eat this? And you say, well, it's because I'm a raw vegan. And, you know, you don't really, it's because you don't want to look like a puss. But also it's like bad for the brand, right?
It wasn't really because I wanted to look like a puss. It was just, I just felt bad for them because like, you know, I think like something that a lot of like vegans run into that aren't there's a certain type of vegan that loves this part, and there's a certain type of vegan that hates this part. They're like trying to just do what they want to do for their own body and politics, and they don't really want to have a conversation about it. Like, you know, but their whole existence becomes a commentary on the person's
hold on. Are you trying to tell me vegans keep it to themselves because they don't want to talk about it?
Well, it's a bias, because how do you know which vegans are keeping it to themselves? Because they keep it themselves.
Well, because they're weird and they won't eat the delicious kebab. That's why.
Well, I mean, we put them into the corner, and you'll probably see like something along the lines like, "Listen, man, everyone can make their choices," which was sort of like my veganism at the time. I was really just trying to like, I was coming at it from more of like the studying Buddhism in college perspective, and just trying to like tread softly upon the earth. You know, this is before everything was politicized a little bit.
You have really, we're like 10 minutes into this, and you've already run the full millennial gamut. Liberal arts degree, vegan chocolate company, raw vegan. Everybody should make their choices. What else? Is there anything I missed?
I don't know. I just wanted to fast forward through that whole thing. And I feel like I've returned now to like, I've sort of like full circled back into my early 20s, where I'm just kind of not really doing much at all right now.
Well, are you a Buddhist again? Have you come full circle to that?
No. I kind of gravitated away from Buddha. They're the way Buddhism handled suffering eventually started to like not res with me. I hold a you know, strong place in my heart. I grew up very a-religious, so Buddhism was probably the most like closest I've ever come to like any sort of religious practice. So it's always going to like hold a bit of sway over my heart. But yeah, I don't think that like, and I'm not even talking about sort of pop Buddhism, but like actually the actual Buddhist texts, even like they're the way like suffering is handled, it feels a little bit more grounded in maybe a time of life when suffering was more just rampant.
Yeah. Well,
and,
I mean, and that's,
yeah. And yeah. I traveled in Southeast Asia for like a year. And so I got to experience Buddhism in like a way that made me not, you know, just like grow more in love with it and also away with it at the same time.
But what school of Buddhism? I mean, Southeast Asia, that's the more, yeah, if I remember so correctly, that's the more
Theravada.
Strict. Yes, that's the stricter.
Yeah, more strict, yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, like got into it like many Westerners through like sort of Zen, but going like Zen meditation centers in like college. And then I lived at a Theravada Buddhist temple for a brief period in Thailand, and got like that kind of flavor, and it was nice. Yeah, I mean, like I guess that just like throw that into like the whole gamut. Like, you know, I guess like the one thing I need to still do is I guess go to the Esalen Institute and like hang out there for a week and like scream into pillows and punch someone. Yeah.
Well, to complete this journey you started.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know.
Sounds like you've been on the ultimate millennials heroes journey for quite a while now.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of conceptions of it. I feel like, yeah, and so it's been interesting to see like sort of like health and wellness, what it's sort of become. Because I kind of worked in that industry for like a while. Because our chocolate company was more of like a health and wellness product, because it was both like vegan and using coconut sugar and organic and stuff. It, like we'd end up, yeah, I just always had a pulse on that place. And I watched it sort of grow like more like weirdly political over the years as like the customer calls got like stranger and stranger.
How so?
Well, like people wanted to know more and more about where the chocolate was coming from. Which we had a pretty dialed supply line. So that
was this because they were concerned about people suffering?
Yeah, it became more and more about like microtoxins and heavy metals inside the chocolate itself.
Okay. And so then how?
It was more about purity.
And then what would you tell them? How do you verify purity? I mean, if microplastics get in everything, I mean, pretty soon no one's going to be able to guarantee that, right? Or I would imagine.
Well, that's kind of what we say. Like also, like we weren't a company that could afford to do like laboratory testing on every like shipment of cacao we got in.
Right.
So we tell them like we test our like farms, new farm we partner with, like, and for heavy metal content. And often heavy metals are pretty high because just like heavy metals run high in cacao just already. But yeah, there's not really much to tell people. And then Prop 65, which is like that California proposition where they label anything that has any sort of cancerous agent in it, like with like a this may cause cancer, which was that was a major blow to like the dark chocolate like industry, because they had to label any dark chocolate product with that label because there was really no way to test if it possibly did have like a little bit higher cadmium than like the recommended limit on the FDA.
And so you had to be able to prove it wasn't there, otherwise you get slapped with that sticker.
Yeah, and like any person could like test any bar and any partner with any headhunter lawyer to take any company down. So it was like, yeah, it was.
Did you get a little libertarian pilled here? Did you start to be like, you know what, the man is keeping small businesses down?
You know, I did a little bit, but like it didn't end up working out because like too bad, because eventually everything got slapped with that label. There's literally like signs outside Disneyland that have that label, because just like touching stuff at Disneyland has the same levels of like cancerous causing substances, I suppose. I don't really know.
But it's not going to hurt them. No one will. That's the thing. People will ignore the sticker at Disneyland, but they won't ignore it on some small businesses. Chocolate or whatever. I mean, I feel like that.
They largely will. And
oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, it really, like, you know.
But you were saying it hurt the dark chocolate industry.
There was a hiccup, and then it like sales kind of leveled.
All right.
Yeah. It was like, you know, and but also, yeah. So less people, and then just I guess that's really the only way I can point to it, like getting sort of politicized. But I noticed, over the years, it felt like a lot more like fundamentalist, like Christians and stuff became a sort of like customer base for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The great crossover.
Yeah. I'm this is occurring to me the first time, but I like never really linked that up with like the whispers of the great Q horseshoe.
Yeah.
But yeah. God, yeah. The
that's the thing.
Whispers were on the air. Yeah.
As I've said many times on here, QAnon is the Marvel universe of conspiracy theories, where they start bringing up, you know, it's a big crossover event with all these different conspiracy theories and disparate, you know, wing nuts and different corners of the internet all kind of coalescing around the Q Great Awakening Extended Universe. And then, you know, also just like bringing up a bunch of old conspiracy theories that, you know, had largely been forgotten, right? But it is the extended conspiracy universe.
I was just rewatching this movie Slackers from 1989.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many characters in that movie that are like, the whole point of the movie is just sort of like Gen X is a bunch of slackers and they all just like rant at each other and they're insufferable. But it's also kind of endearing because, like, I don't know, they seem cool while they're doing it for some reason, even though they seem lame and cool at the same time. But like so many of the stuff is just like about children going missing and like government complexes and great cabals and plans. And it's just like, it's like, you know, it wasn't like an aha moment, but it's just like always, they're always reminded about how long this stuff has been rolling around, you know? And it's,
yeah. And you had the X-Files, you had Twin Peaks, you had all this stuff. But in the 90s, I think, as I've said a couple of times before, but in the 90s, the mystery box is still fun.
Slackers was a fun movie,
right?
Yeah.
If you could see in the mystery box, it's going to be like aliens getting people pregnant, you know. It's still terrifying, but it's still kind of fun. And then I think after 9/11, the mystery box becomes, I don't want to look in it because inside there's going to be, you know, just an Abu Ghraib or something like that, or Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah.
It's not fun anymore.
Well, we didn't have the images to go with it like we do now. You know, like there's too much visual accompaniment to the box to make it pleasant to hang out in. Or at least, I don't know. That's a theory.
Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense because there's more images now than ever.
Yeah. And like, as the images ramp up and get like more doubtfully true or false, like we kind of, the box gets kookier and the people willing to look at it go madder. I don't know, more theories. But yeah, needless to say, veganism has changed over the years.
So you were talking about the younger generation, Gen Z. I've read stuff saying that, you know, they're drinking less. This sort of thing, they're healthier, they're having less sex, this sort of stuff. And my take on it is that stuff isn't necessarily bad in and of itself. It's just that are they doing that because they're making a conscious choice to be healthier or more self-controlled? Or is it just that they're the most introverted or isolated generation we've ever had? Any insight on what's going on there?
I doubt that they're actually healthier, because I mean, I hear a lot of talk about this type of stuff, but it's also like, I don't know the brass tacks. Like how many of these posters are actually walking the walk? Like when you look at their diets, like, are they actually just eating that way, or are they just posting about it? Cause I see a lot of the same people, like, you know, talking a lot about Bang energy drinks. And so it's hard to know, like, is it all sort of a joke and a LARP? Because in our, like, in my experience is like, it's very expensive to eat well in this country. And especially if you're going down the holistic train of like raw dairy and pastured eggs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And in my experience at the company, like, young people didn't buy our stuff very much because it was pricey. It was mostly like middle-aged and elderly people, mostly women, because
they tend to be, well, they like chocolate more and they're probably going to be more interested in the fancy stuff.
Yeah, and they're like kind of more like, you know, in charge of like buying the family's food a lot of the time,
right?
At least in like the Midwest, I imagine. I don't know, theories. But, you know, this is one of those weird things I like had to think about, because I had to think about like, what is our demographic as we grew as a company, you know, because it's sort of like we're a bunch of dudes selling this chocolate. So we had to like, all right, well, like, we can't just like dude out in our like branding. So, yeah.
Well, maybe.
I mean,
you could make the ultra masculine high testosterone vegan chocolate.
Yeah.
Though I don't think your average vegan male is going to be too concerned.
That just feels like incredibly feminine, though, to make a very like ultra masculine chocolate bar. Like,
all right. When you got out of the chocolate business, what did you do next?
I mean, after the demic, I just kind of was like a little bit jaded with like business in general, I guess. And I started to get back into like reading philosophy a lot, and really didn't want to.
Who did you start with?
Who did I start? Well, you know, I mean, I've never really stopped reading like heady stuff over like since college, but like I hadn't really like, you know, I found Mark Fisher and then went through that portal.
Okay.
And, you know, like moved from like Buddhist texts and into like that realm. And and then pretty like got pretty into Deleuze pretty fast and kind of haven't looked back from there. And I've just picked up a lot of different stuff and put it down, you know, like, but yeah, I would say mostly over the course since then, I've just been reading a lot of Deleuze, and I haven't really picked up another gig. Like right now I work at a couple of bookstores and just live in Arizona and write a lot and try to, yeah, write a lot, read a lot, run a lot, and, you know, spend a lot of time making food because I, you know, still try to eat.
Are you still a foodie?
I wouldn't describe myself as a foodie because like I don't really go out to eat much because I don't really think the quality of food is that good when you go out to eat much. So I like to kind of like keep my punch card for like good spots, you know, like, so going to like my favorite nostalgic Mexican food restaurant in San Diego is like that's like a punch in the card, you know? And also because I have some like lingering orthorexia, because as all once raw vegans probably do, you know.
What is that? Orthorexia?
Orthorexia
I'm not familiar.
Is a like kind of it's a food relationship that is like over concerned with the purity of the food that ends up being a sort of like obsessive compulsive nature to, you know, it's like, you know, it's because it's a never ending cycle, like how pure your food can be. Like, and so.
Oh, I see. Like, so it's like food dysmorphia.
A little bit. Yeah. I mean, it's like sort of, yeah, it's not, it doesn't really have to
do. It doesn't
do
matter how clean the water is, you're still going to see germs in there somehow.
Yeah, well, it's more just like a, like, all right, well, is this food organic? Okay, well, if it's organic, is it like, was it grown on a small farm? What was the soil quality like? Oh, well, how long ago was it picked? Oh, well, how, and then it just goes on from there.
All right.
And
you're saying you still struggle with this mentality a little bit.
I don't really anymore, I don't think, but like, also my preferences just like really changed over the years. So I don't really like to like, I don't know. It does feel good to eat like a less processed diet, I feel like. So I just don't really gravitate. Also, I'm a 35, so I can't really, you know, blow out on like crap food all the time. Or maybe I could. I don't really know. You know, if I
what do you
think, well,
what,
maybe
what,
I should
what,
just
what,
try it for a week.
What's a Sean Jewell approved breakfast?
I don't really eat breakfast so much. I actually, I mean,
okay, little. All right, so the
I make a very
fasting.
Rich, like, I make a very rich cocoa, and then just sort of like drink that. So it's like kind of breakfast. It's probably got like 300 to 500 calories in it, and like a bunch of, you know, it's like an herb tea blend, lots of different stuff. I kind of like put different herbs in there that I feel like my body might be needing at any given time. And
what's a Sean Jewell approved lunch?
Lunch, maybe eggs, roasted sweet potato, and some steamed greens, or like, yeah, that's, or any sort of like, you know, animal protein, sweet potato, greens, or potatoes.
What would you say is your go-to dinner?
Kind of the same thing. Lunch and dinner kind of are interchangeable.
Okay, all right. Yeah. This is starting to sound a little Spartan to me. And
yeah, it's pretty Spartan. It's incredibly Spartan.
Okay.
But, you know, a few good, like some good spice blends, you get a good curry blend or a good, like taco seasoning, like those go a long way. If you,
right.
You know, if you're Spartan. Also, sweet potatoes are fucking delicious. If people know how to cook them, they know how to buy them. Like yams, eh, but like the Japanese purple skin, white flesh sweet potatoes, those are really good.
I would consider this foodie talk. I don't know how else to describe how you're describing things to me.
Okay. So maybe, yeah, but it's,
is there another term you would like to use?
I mean, I guess, well, it's like, you know, oh my God, I love Turkish food or something like that. It's like not that type of food talk.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
You know, it's like sort of like you have to try like this restaurant because it does an amazing ceviche. Like that's kind of what I think of like this food talk. I don't
know
about
anything.
I
see. All right. That's fair enough.
I'm an adventurous eater. Whenever I've traveled, I'm kind of like down to like try the local fare. I'm not really turned off by like a weird type of meat or something like that. You know, that's another thing. It was like, it's gotten really funny. Like people talk about eating organ meats now, like fuck, we're doing that in like 2013,
right?
I mean,
well, so
know,
I guess, yeah, I guess a lot
thousands
of
years, but like, but yeah, but yeah, damn, we were gonna talk about the lose on this episode, but whatever,
we're still getting there. You said you started running. Has this been something you've always done, or is this something that started up after you?
I've always been sort of like fitness oriented. I got a job as a bike courier in college, and then I feel like I just like found out I really liked a shit ton of physical activity in my day, and it never really dialed back. And so I got into, I kept biking all throughout veganism, and then hiking a lot and going on backpacking trips, and then kind of crashed out of veganism into paleo CrossFit world, which is sort of like a pretty common arc for a lot of vegans. And then paleo kind of like in the mid 2010s, the mid aughts, like paleo and CrossFit were having a parallel moment.
I do remember this.
Yeah.
I do remember this.
Yeah. Remember that? It was sort of, and like a lot of those people got Q-pilled. I guarantee you that. But yeah, because there was also like a, but that's kind of what I grew out of is sort of like, it was like oddly right wing. And so I kind of like gravitated away, but I really liked weightlifting. So I was into weightlifting for a minute. And it was like fun to actually, like, I was such a scrawny guy for so long. It was like fun to actually like see like muscles on my body for like the first time, you know, in like a sort of like, oh, you know, because there's something very gratifying about weightlifting in a sense where it's like your progress is so like linear and recordable. Like just like last week, it was that number. This week, it is this number. That number is higher. And that is undeniable. And like, I don't know. There's not that many things like that these days, you know? And I think it's also like, so it feels very powerful. Like it's like a way of taking control over your own form. You know, I think that's what part of what bodybuilding is so, you know, I mean, ever since like, you know, that documentary with like Arnold Schwarzenegger, like got big, I forget the name of that one, but like people like, yeah, it's just like exerting control over your own body. It feels like sort of like a reclamation in a way. And I feel like that's sort of the part of fitness that doesn't really get talked about so much, which is unfortunate, is it like, it really is like empowering to sort of take control of your own form. And, but yeah, but that got politicized too, in a weird way, which is unfortunate. But yeah, from there, I just got into running. I just started, like, I went for a couple of runs. I forget when it happened. I started, like, I just think it was like hiking a lot. And I'm like, maybe I'll see people running past me all the time and wondering, how the hell does anyone do that? And so I just got into trail running, and slowly but surely trail running became my like main gig. So now I'm kind of back to like a scrawny guy again. But by choice.
But a scrawny guy with good cardio, right?
Yeah, with really good cardio. And you know, what's great about like building muscle is it never really went away. The definition kind of stayed, you know? And yeah, and that's nice. I feel like if I really wanted to, I could bulk up pretty quick because I built the foundation, you know? And I know that, I know the moves. I know the moves. I know the go-tos. I know the you know, the biggest bang for my buck. And but yeah, but like running turned into like marathoning turned into ultra marathoning, and that's sort of my main shtick right now. I've got like the sort of
all right. So it sounds like you're still a pretty health pilled, clean living guy.
Yeah. I'm definitely a healthy, clean living guy. I've relaxed a lot. I've learned that like the stress, because that was another thing, is like working in that industry, is you realize those most stressed out people look the least healthy to me. Working at the farmer's market, the people who are the most worried about food seemed like to be thriving the least. And it was hard to know, because maybe they're the worst worried about food because they have so much health stuff, and that's what making them not thrive. But me, for whatever it is, it intimidated me into thinking like, I gotta chill the fuck out. And so I chilled out, and it served me for what it's worth.
Do you have any vices? Do you still drink? Smoking the weed, hitting the reefer?
For years, I lived so like monkish. Like I didn't like, I was a vegan straight edge who didn't really like try to be one or listen to hardcore. And slowly but surely I started to like, chill out. Which kind of started with psychedelics, actually, like trying psychedelics for the first time.
Which ones?
First psychedelic I really did, aside from smoking salvia one time in high school in a park, was ayahuasca.
Worst introduction you could have, actually.
No, it was rad. It was fun, but wasn't fun for everyone. Fun for me, but right. Yeah. But yeah, the first one was like ayahuasca when I was 29, and okay.
And this is ayahuasca proper. This is not just DMT.
Ayahuasca, pretty proper. Like recommended by a friend to a group that was doing it right. Definitely felt like they did it right when I was there. And then, did that several times with that group. And just like one of the things, like, I think that kind of coincided with my, I got to stress out less, because I just realized like, I just have to relax out of some compulsions, you know, which is going to be.
But what was that actual experience like?
The first time doing ayahuasca was like, I was so afraid of psychedelics for so long because I was just sure the moment one touched my lips, all the skeletons of my life would come pouring out and like just dance around me, like with like holding knives and take tiny cuts. And I would just be in a hell realm for the entire duration of the psychedelic. And then what actually happened was it was just incredibly pleasant. Like I didn't vomit once. There was like, my body just felt nice and buzzy, and it just felt like, just like, God damn, this is like the lightest I've felt in like years, which I think I don't think that speaks to like what ayahuasca is like, but more speaks to like, ayahuasca is a type of plant medicine that meets you where you're at.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, cause like there are definitely a lot of other people who are having a rough night.
Was it more so, it sounds like you had like you're describing kind of a pleasant body high, but did you have an actual visionary experience that led you to be like,
aside from the sort of like Alex Gray fractal universe, nothing super visual, nothing I can point to, like a serpent, like riding a jaguar gallivanted in front of me and told me that I need to think of my grandmother more often or something like that. Like nothing visually discernible. But I do remember one time, like, there was a guy who was sitting next to me, and like I was like, just have my eyes shut, and I'm just chilling out, watching like the visuals, and like I see like a void in the visuals that were next to me, and like I'm like, fuck, like that guy is not going to be sitting there. He's going to be like, have moved somewhere else in the room. He's going to be gone, and I'm going to have to realize the only evidence I have of him being gone is that like his visual energy field is not appearing before my eyes, and I. wasn't really ready for that to be a thing. And out my eyes, and he was gone. And it could be that I just heard him leave and forgot or something like that. Didn't feel that way, though. Still doesn't. Mm-hmm. And it's more fun to believe that that wasn't the case now. At the time, it was intimidating as hell. But,
and this wasn't... Your first experience with ayahuasca wasn't your last.
No. I've done it close to 10 times, I think.
All right. Any heavier trips? Any stuff that was a little more difficult?
You know, every time I've done it, I've never really had a super heavy trip. I've cried a little bit, you know, every now and again, mostly laughed a lot. I've laughed a lot. I'm like a laugher. Yeah, pretty much every psychedelic, like something seems so irreverently ridiculous that I can't control myself.
Mm-hmm.
And, but yeah, I've never really had a bad time. I've never even vomited or anything. And it was cool because the year 2019, I had the chance to go into Ecuador, into like the indigenous community that my like ayahuasquero had studied with, and like do it with his like ayahuasquero trainer. And that was like the lightest one I've ever had. That one was also, but like trippy shit was also happening in that one, just in the actual like place. But
like what?
Well, like, I remember like I was wearing like a Casio watch, and I like took it off and like left it like in my like tent before we went out there. Cause I'm like, well, I'm not going to wear a Casio watch to an ayahuasca ceremony. That seems a little ridiculous. And then I'm like I was kind of all prepared for this shaman to be like full regalia. This is going to be intense. Like, this is the real deal. Like, I need to like, you know, I got to mind my P's and Q's here, really respect the environment. And so I'm sitting there just trying to like, you know, ramp up for this. And he shows up 45 minutes late wearing like dirty gym shorts and a t-shirt, and carrying like a plastic bottle that looks like it's full of diesel fuel, which is the ayahuasca we're going to be drinking, like a repurposed like Coke bottle, like pint. And he's wearing a Casio watch. And I was like, God damn it. I felt like he was just trolling me specifically.
Yeah. He was wearing your Casio watch.
That's the thing, is there's no way he could have, because we had to like take a canoe from the place where our tents were. Like, so there's a world where that seems like a too long a con. But
I just love that he's late and metaphorically wearing your watch, and that you also find out that being a shaman is still a job, and he's not necessarily like any different from any other working job.
Yeah. And and he looked like so just like, God damn it, these Westerners, which was so fair. But like, but I think it was part of his act too, in a weird way, was like he was just trying to like de-stress the situation.
Mm-hmm.
but also kind of stress it in a weird way, because it is sort of like, you know, like building rather than like some sort of like ceramic vessel, like carved with anacondas, we were drinking it out of like a fucking, like a Pepsi pint bottle.
But that's actually the most, so you, but that's the thing. It's probably more authentic that way than doing it with all the,
yeah. Ironically. Yeah. Like, you know, like there are no untouched peoples, and, yeah. It was, you know, it was part of my like hubris to think, to like, you know, to think that. And it, and they, if like, and so, yeah, in a way it was like a reformed respect. He's like, this is how it's done here now. You know, this Pepsi bottle fucking, it works better to hold this shit. It's got a lid that screws real tight. You know, I could drop it and it just kind of bounces. Like, it's great. And so, but yeah, and that night, like, when I took it, it was just really mellow. That was, yeah, 2019. And the strongest message I got was just sort of like that, you know what you got to do. Here's some visuals. Chill out for a while. Get back to work. Like, come clap at me when you got something to say.
How would you say philosophy, and your lifelong pursuit of philosophy and even like Buddhism and spirituality and maybe even health culture and all this stuff, how does that inform what you do now? How does that, I mean, does it affect the way that you run? Does it affect the way you think about what is the supreme form of yam?
Yeah, I mean, it affects everything and complexifies everything, which is like the constant balance of being like a heavy reader. I feel like, you know, it's hard to balance input with output. And so, because it's like sort of like my, I've always kind of like, I mean, from the beginning, I was like, yeah, but what's this for? What's the praxis here? Like, what is Buddhism going to do for me? Like, I don't really want to know the most Buddhist texts. Like, I want to be a happy person. And yeah, and that's sort of been, you know, so it's like, it's as the decades pass, I realized, all right, like for me, being happy is like a constant recalibration and a constant like re-knowing of old things and learning of new things, lumping old things into new things. And yeah, it lumps very deeply into running, like, and into health and into like, you know, it helps, it's created all my rules and it's created my violations for those rules. And it's created the timing for those violations of those rules. And it lets me, I think the biggest thing it does is makes it harder to trick myself. Like, I know when I'm rationalizing a thing, you know, or at least I know when I'm captured by something.
All right. What would you say? What would you say was the biggest rationalization you caught yourself in?
Biggest rationalization I caught myself. The biggest one in my 20s was probably that, like, being too healthy was actually killing me. Which is
that
like,
that sounds true.
Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, like, I was rational, like, that was the shattering of the rationalization. Because the rationalization that was being enforced was, like, how could being healthy be bad?
Oh, I see, you know? I see. All right.
Yeah. So the biggest rationalization, which it was easy to rationalize that with Buddhism, because, like, I'm only eating fruit. I'm walking. I like, you know, I'd sort of, like, apothecize stories of monks living in, like, you know, meditating outside of caves and eating only what monkeys brought them, you know, which was, like, that seemed like the fucking life to me. And yeah, so like I was kind of living that way in Oakland, which was not really sustainable. And so I came out of that via, yeah, just kind of reading more, like working at farmers markets and seeing more about like holistic, like more like holistic ways of like dealing with animals and finding sort of ways that animals were being raised and slaughtered that I couldn't really disagree with. My biggest like come to Jesus moment, I think, at like a being a vegan was like one time where I was like eating like a tofu dog and like kind of getting on my like high horse about it. And This was actually 4 or 5 years before I stopped being, or like no, 2 or 3 years before I stopped being a vegan. But like on that moment, I kind of knew like, I think this is unwinding. Was my friend who was like eating like a boar sausage that she got from the farmer's market was like, what the fuck's in that? I know what's in this. My friend who killed his boar that he loved. And I was like, well, fuck me. I have no idea what's in this thing. And yeah, so there are a lot of rationalizations that come in with food in general. general, I think for everybody. And it's just about like, you know, it's hard to eat, man. But yeah. And then in my 30s, I would say my biggest sort of delusion was that like, I was a business person. I was someone who wanted to like work in a company, not even like work in a company, but like, I wanted to build this like chocolate company. I wanted to prove that like conscious capitalism was a thing, that like, you could build a chocolate company that had full chain, like, positivity.
Nomadic chocolate machine. Sounds good to me.
Yeah, nomadic chocolate machine. Yeah. And I feel like I failed at that. I got close and I realized not that it was impossible, but that I wasn't the one to do it if it was. And maybe that was the harsh pill, really, at the end of the day.
Ooh, harsh pill? That's a new pill.
It's a new pill.
This was all leading up to getting harsh pilled. That's the end of the millennials hero's journey.
Harsh pills are the end of everyone's journey, I feel like.
Oh, that is what a harsh pilled person would say, though, wouldn't he?
That's fair. But yeah, you know, it's you know, you
hold on a second, because you wanted to talk about the Lose. I don't see him as a harsh pilled guy necessarily at all.
I kind of feel like most of Deleuze's writings is someone trying. It's, to me, it feels like someone trying to stave off harsh pills with like a system of like.
It's a bunch of cope pills.
It's a bunch of cope pills. Yeah. Which is like, I mean, okay. Like, if like, you know, it's just like, if like, what's my relationship to philosophy? Well, on a level, it's just like, I want to eat handfuls of cope pills for the rest of my life. But yeah, but also like there is a sort of like, because like that's the thing. It's like, as you eat a cope pill, you need to like sort of like, you know, when you read a lot of Deleuze, you start to like, the world starts to crumble in a very weird way. And you got to find new cope pills to deal with that crumbling. You cope for a minute and then you're like, well, actually that cope pill is starting to unravel reality.
You're like you're getting deterritorialized, and now you want to
getting deterritorialized. And like very often in Deleuze's writing and Deleuze and Guattari's writing, they talk about how like, you can't do this too fast. You have to like, you got to titrate this thing, you know, like you gotta take sips
Hold on a second. You think you went on this sort of quest of trying to what? Territorialize yourself? Or deterritorialize yourself, and then in the end you kind of have to look back on everything with a certain sense of irony and say, well, now I'm harsh pilled, the best thing I can do for myself is not rationalize things, because that sounds very Freudian to me.
I wouldn't say I'm sort of like someone who has a sort of cynical, maybe like cynical bodysuit over like a heart of like optimism, you know. And I think a lot of people have like an optimism bodysuit over a heart of cynicism.
Well, but this doesn't sound very harsh pilled anymore.
Harsh pill
didn't even last, you know, 5 minutes, Sean.
Like, you know, it's like, well, I mean, an optimistic person can, you know, tolerate some harsh pills,
some harsh crack.
Yeah, it's
wears off and you have to get more.
You know, it's like, we need optimistic people to be swallowing these harsh pills and be territorializing all this stuff because they're the ones that can stomach it, you know? Like,
okay, but I assume because maybe that's why I never bombed
my ayahuasca ceremony. I can digest it, man. Give it to me. I got a strong stomach.
Maybe, because I have never heard of anyone doing ayahuasca and not and just being chill almost the entire time, every time. So maybe it's a lack of negativity in your life overall that has led you to being harsh pilled, because it's the last thing for you to overcome.
Possibly, you know, it's like, I mean, that's sort of another sort of, I feel like, rabbit hole of like, is this, there's this perpetual, like, I am always about to shatter the glass ceiling and realize the grand realization and, you know, ascend. But like, you know, as you get older, you realize like, oh, there's, you know, and reading Deleuze's helped me, is like, there's no ascension. There's just ascending. Like, you know, you're just becoming, you're just becoming all the time. You're unfolding and you're refolding and folding into new things. And you just got to like rock out on that for the most part, to very oversimplify things. But, But yeah, because like, I mean, once you start the thing, it's like sort of like, it unpacks what we've built in a way that makes it seem like there's no we and there's no building. It's all just this thing that's like forming and reforming and unforming. This thing we're calling capitalism isn't capitalism. How can you call something the same thing for, since some like dudes got really excited about tulips? How do you keep naming this? There's no way to name anything because you can't keep naming things, new things all the time. I feel like that's something that we're really coming up against in sort of like mimetic culture right now, where everyone's, and there's sort of an irony around it where everyone, you know, the like sort of tired point of like talking about the phenomena of like young Zoomers naming themselves each individually with their own sort of political ideology, you know, insert yeah, like kid that, one, you yeah, know,
but that's a lot of. That's a lot of people who are able to create a politics that doesn't have to exist in reality. And I guess there's something kind of delusional about that because they're in this weird rhizomal internet space where you can do that and where that can survive. But that's the thing with D&G. It's like, I do take the Nick Land view that it's not so much that they're describing what being is, it's that they're describing the future, you know, what the future would be. And then when you say, well, how do we define capitalism? I mean, I would fall back on the history of the thing defines the thing. So capitalism's had many transmutations, but the thing that has stayed consistent is the private ownership of capital.
Yeah, but like as that private ownership is getting more complex and weird though. Because
yes, it definitely
fluctuates so quickly. And like the thing you own isn't real and could like fall out from underneath you in a matter of like days or seconds. And so, I'm willing to entertain it. Like the thing at the gem of that, this sort of, as the oscillations of this flywheel increase in sort of like this like fever pitch level where like the bolts are flying off, like, the axle in the middle of that is capitalism that still remains there. It's like, yeah, I could get with that, but it's sort of weird to debate what to call a thing to at the end of the day, which I'm not saying you're doing. It's just like, I don't know. It's hard to define the problem when the thing that's the problem is changing so fast. Like, what do we do? Remove private property or something like that? Like maybe, but like everything, I mean, yeah, and I agree that there's sort of like, there is a sort of like Nick Landian propheticness to like Deleuze and Guattari that does seem like very dystopic and inevitable, where like that speed does just like move to such a fever pitch level that like the only thing our bodies can do to keep up with the unstoppable pace that will not cease is to sort of transcend themselves and enter into it in some sort of, you know, weird like digital singularity way, which is sort of just like a way of our bodies, a way of disappearing so that we don't disappear in a weird way, which I don't know, it just seems like quite the Ouroboros to me.
But Sean, you started a Substack? Are you starting a Substack?
Yeah, I started
writing
one,
something. What's going on?
Yeah, I've started one about a year ago, and I just write there. That's really the only social media presence I have by choice. So I write poetry, prose, critiques, some like stranger philosophy posts. Lately I've been really into fiction. So I'm thinking about, finally found some characters that I like, but I'm thinking about stretching into maybe a novella.
Cool. But anything you want to read? Anything you want to showcase? Anything you want to hype?
I'm not a good like reader, but I would love if you want to check it out, please go to my Substack, read a few posts. If you like it, follow. If you like it a lot,
read a poem right now.
Read as a poem. You're gonna have to. Are you willing to patiently wait while I pull one up?
Yes.
Okay. You wanna. They all kind of end optimistically, but do you want one that's
okay?
Like,
do you want to find a harsh-pilled poem,
like a dark arc?
what I, you know, the spirit's telling me that you need to face the challenge of reading a poem of yours into the mic. So whatever you are compelled to choose, I will accept.
I'm going to read The Parable of Two Wolves. The Parable of Two Wolves goes like this. Inside me, there are two wolves. They make love often. In time, inside of me, there are many more wolves. Exponential rumble-tumble love cubs. Population growth as my life lives me. A wolf rhizome expands its threshold over me, and inside me, some wolves, joy, peace, love, humility, kindness, empathy, generosity, truth wolves, seem better than other fear, anger, sorrow, regret, greed, guilt, resentment, self-doubt wolves. And just as inside me, some parts, joy, peace, love, humility, kindness, empathy, generosity, truth parts, seem better than other fear, anger, sorrow, regret, greed, guilt, resentment, self-doubt parts, the parable instructs me to feed the better wolves and to starve the worse wolves. I hear this metaphorical preferential feeding starvation regimen echoed out of youth NA meetings and corporate wellness retreats and insurance subsidized telecounseling via Zoom. This metaphorical preferential feeding starvation regimen is supposed to be of some therapeutic utility, provided that the wolf I choose to nourish is better than the wolf I choose to kill. This is not my parable. This is a cruel parable because it takes a long time to starve my wolf, and it's longer than I'm willing to watch a wolf suffer. The wolves of this parable are metaphorical, so the meat I feed them can be infinite if I choose metaphorically. I won't starve myself all or part. I choose infinite meat. My parable of two wolves will now go like this. Inside me, there are two wolves. I toss meat out with abandon. The angry wolves stay livid. The happy wolves stay content. And the sad wolves go on whining. And they make love often, making love cubs of ever more ambiguous virtue sin wolves. Cryptic, undiscerning, witless, baffling, revolutionary, hedonistic, industrious, circuitous, great bravado, codependent, loyal, naive, duplicitous, and weird wolves. Rise up over my metaphor. I rise up over my metaphor, taking in the visuals, the soft, saggy rhizome of frenzied undulations of multiplicitous wolves. I hear the fighting, loving, howling cacophony. I hear it as harmony, a drone to drown in. And I dive in, wearing a Lady Gaga raw meat dress, double-fisting fresh-skinned hairs. In my mouth, a flaming sacred heart. Hello, wolves. I am your container and carry-on. I'm here to feed you with my life, indiscriminately. I want to become my pack of wolves. None shall starve. You are what you eat. Feast. And when the wolves are snoozing, meat drunk, quiet and satiated, bellies full of meat bursting, life rushes to meet me. That is the poem.
See, and you're trying to tell me that you're not a good reader. That was excellent. Thank you very much.
Was it good? Okay, good. Thank you.
All right. And what is the name of the Substack?
Eternal Return Press. But right,
and obviously, I will include a link as
links
well.
Links are the only way anyone's going to ever find anything.
No one knows. Exactly. All right. Mr. Sean Jewell, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, man. I appreciate you.
Appreciate it.